I want to welcome those who are listening to the podcast, and we are now at lesson number 11, entitled Herod the Great, the King of the Jews. We are in our study between the Testaments, where we've been examining the time period from the close of the Old Testament and the book of Malachi to the opening of the New Testament and the book of Matthew. We've covered a great deal of ground, and tonight I'm not going to review what we've said in lessons 1 through 9 about the five empires. By now, I hope that they are permanently imprinted in your mind, but I will review this evening what we discussed last week. And I believe you'll find this study particularly fascinating because I will be showing you the reign of the man you know as King Herod, the King of the Jews, Herod the Great, the king that was on the throne of Judea when the Messiah was born, the king who interacted with the wise men, who said to the wise men that had come from the east, asking the question, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? Go find him. When you have found him, bring me word again that I may come and worship him." But in reality, Herod wanted to kill the newborn Jesus. And in his attempt to do so, he killed every Jewish boy 2 years and under. This is the Herod of the New Testament. This is the Herod you read about in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 2, in Luke chapter 1 and chapter 2. Last week, we divided his life into three phases. He was born in 73 BC, and he was anointed king of the Jews by the Roman Senate in 40 BC. And we traced those 33 years last week. Tonight, we're going to be looking at the second time period, from 40 B.C., when he was coronated King of the Jews by the Roman Senate, all the way down to 4 B.C., which is the year of the birth of Jesus Christ. Now, I am sure some of you will ask the question, now, wait a minute, if B.C. means before Christ, why was Jesus born in 4 B.C.? Would not he have been born at the time of 0? So that then you start counting the years after Christ, A.D., or the year of our Lord, Anno Domini. Why are you saying he was born in 4 B.C.? Well, I don't have time to answer that question except to say when the calendar was first started way, 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 way back, they divided the years to before Christ, B.C., and Anno Domini, the year of our Lord, after Christ was born. But they'd made a mistake in measuring the Earth's revolution around the sun. And it all has to do with leap years and leap days and so on. And by the time they corrected it in the Middle Ages, you had to move the birth of Jesus back to 4 BC in order for it to be an accurate count according to the solar year as we measure it today. By the way, before we established what we would call the Christian calendar or the calendar of the West, meaning B.C. and A.D., time was measured by the reigns of the Roman kings or the Olympiads. The Greeks measured time that way. So if you read ancient books like I do, you'll come across a book that says, and in the third year of the 20th Olympiad. And because I've read enough about it, I know exactly what year that is. The Olympics started in 776 B.C. and everything was measured according to the Olympics. And then the Roman kings when Rome took over. And then it was only later that we received what we call our Christian calendar, the Western calendar. So the third time period is 4 BC to 2 BC. And we'll be looking at that next week. And I'm going to show you that 2-year time period when Herod the Great, King of the Jews, dies in 2 BC. And how his kingdom is divided. And then next Wednesday night, if you can make it, you really need to be here because I'm going to show you there are many Herods mentioned in the New Testament, and I'm going to point out exactly who they are. They're the sons of Herod, and they're all called Herod. Like we said before, George Foreman, the boxer, had 7 sons, and he named them all George. Herod did the same thing with his boys. So I'm going to explain to you who they were. And I think it will help you understand the scripture more. Now, when you read about Herod the Great, You will most often read that he died in 4 BC, within weeks after the birth of Jesus Christ. But recent evidence, and I think it is overwhelmingly convincing, Herod died in 2 BC, 2 years after the birth of Christ. And we'll get into that next week as well. But the reason I believe it's important is because the wise men who came from the east came well after Jesus was born in the manger. Unlike the modern manger creche that you see today, the creche is an old word for nativity. By the way, in our Christmas series this year, it's entitled The Christmas Creche. And there wasn't but maybe two people on our staff who even knew what the word creche meant. I want to ask you here in this room, and by a show of hands, and don't be embarrassed if you don't know because your pastoral staff didn't know. How many of you know the definition of creche? Raise your hand. One. Oh, my. Just a couple. Wow. We've got our work cut out for us. It's an old German word that just means nativity. That's all. It just means nativity. So when you see a nativity scene, you will see the wise men bowing at the manger. Well, that didn't happen. The wise men came later, after the shepherds had already left and so on and so on and so on. So it was probably 1 to 2 years after Jesus was born. We'll talk about the death of Herod next week. The five empires are on the screen. I'll just mention them. The Assyrian, the Babylonian, the Persian, the Grecian, the Roman empires. We've gone over and over these again and again. So now, hopefully, they're just permanently sealed into your mind. Before we continue tonight, I want to do something very simple. For those of you who are very familiar with counting years before Christ and counting years after Christ, I mean, this will be old hat to you. This will be kindergarten, but I don't want to assume that counting years is easy. So let me just give you some help. When we talk about the years before Christ, you have to count down. Count down. BC, you always count down. For instance, when you use the phrase the first century BC, you have to count down from 99 BC all the way down to the birth of Christ, 99, 98, and so on. When you use the phrase second century BC, you've got to count down from 199 to 100. All the ones, if you will, are the second century BC. But in AD, after Jesus was born, you count up. So the first century AD is from 1 to 99. The second century AD is from 100 to 199. Now, the best way to illustrate it would be like a rocket launch. Let's say that there's a rocket sitting on a launching pad at NASA, and you have a countdown before launch. That's BC. Before Christ, you count down. Then the rocket is launched. Christ is born. Then you've got a clock that counts up. It's been 5 minutes since launch, 5 years since the birth of Christ, 100 years since the birth of Christ. So a little test for you is this. When we say the 20th century AD, what are the years that we're talking about? The 1900s. We are right now in the 21st century AD, which is the 2000s. So when we say the 20th century BC, we're talking about the 1900s before Christ. You count down BC, you count up AD. And one little more tidbit that if you do this, I mean, you're a college graduate. BC is always after the year. So it's 140 BC. AD is always before the year. AD 140. So just remember that. BC comes after the year. AD is always before the year. Okay? So that's a little lesson on counting years. From 586 BC, counting down to 103 BC, the Jews had no kings that reigned over them. We've been looking at this. Jerusalem fell in 586, And Judea was just a colony of Babylon first, and then a colony of Persia. They had no kings. They were a province, if you will, of the great empires of Babylon and then of Persia. And also the Greeks. When the Greeks kicked the Persians out of the Middle East under the reign of Alexander the Great, the Greeks made Judea their colony. There were no kings until the Jews kicked out the Greeks in 103 BC and established a second dynasty of kings called the Hasmonean dynasty. We've been studying this. Now, what's fascinating on the map that you're looking at on the screen, this is a picture of the Greek Empire. And here is Israel. It's the land bridge between Africa and Persia. Iran and Iraq and Turkey and so on. Israel's right in the middle. So it's the land bridge between Africa and Asia, and then Europe is over here. So Judea is a province for over 400 years with no kings. And as we've seen in our study, when Alexander died, his Grecian kingdom, his Grecian empire, which had defeated the Persians, broke into two major empires. Seleucus, the general under Alexander, started the Seleucid Empire, which encompassed most of Iran and Iraq and most of Asia Minor, and then Ptolemy took the rich kingdom of Africa, what we know as Egypt. And as we have seen in our study, one of the great kings of the Seleucid Empire, who would eventually suppress the Ptolemies and made them stay in Egypt and said, "We want you out of the Middle East. We're controlling it all." One of the great kings of the Seleucids was a fellow by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. He was wicked, but he was powerful. And he put a statue of Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem. And that's what angered the Jews so much that they started a revolt against the Greeks, led by a priest named Mattathias. His sons were known as the Maccabees. Judas Maccabeus took over after his father Mattathias died. Maccabee means hammer, but it's also an acrostic from Exodus 15:11. "Who is like you among the heavenly gods, Lord?" And it was the Maccabees who established another dynasty of kings beginning in 103 BC. But the problem with the Maccabees, who were Jews who kicked out the Greeks, the problem with them is they were not from the house of Zadok, and they were not from the house of David. So when they took over the throne, which according to Scripture, to Yahweh's word, only the descendants of David could own. That's why when the Messiah was born, the angel said, "And he shall reign over the house of David forever." Well, the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, was another name for them. They were not from the house of David. And when they took the high priesthood, they were not from the house of Zadok, who was the high priest during the reign of David. And so what you've got here in 103 BC, 100 years before Christ is born, you've got Maccabees who've taken the throne and the priesthood. And there's some Jews that are really upset with that, some Orthodox Jews. And these Orthodox Jews, we know them as the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. They do not like what the Maccabeans have done. And so you've got a split. I've given you the charts of the Maccabean family, those who reigned as kings. We've looked over that. So we just have progressed now to the Roman Empire. The Maccabees were Jews, and they threw off Greek rule, and they quickly made an alliance with the Romans. And where we're coming to tonight is how King Herod is that man who is the connection between Julius Caesar, the Romans, the Greeks, the Jews. He's the man that ties everything together. So this evening, we're going to take a look at King Herod the Great and how he ruled over the Jews during the time the Romans began to conquer the world. The Jews allowed him to reign as king of the Jews, and we saw how he became king of the Jews last week. You remember what we said? We said that when John Hyrcanus, a Maccabean, who was the first person to declare himself high priest, when he was high priest, he took his troops down to the land of Edom. These are the descendants of Esau. And he forcibly converted the Edomites to faith in Yahweh. What he said was this: you will become worshipers of Yahweh, believe the Torah, and circumcise your boys, or you will die. And that's exactly what the Edomites did. The capital of Edom, they converted. The capital of Edom was Petra. Herod is born in 73 BC in the city of Petra. And his grandfather had been forcibly converted to Judaism. But Herod was not a Jew. He was an Edomite. He was a descendant of Esau, not Jacob. He was an Edomite. And he was born in Petra. But he was born into a family that had converted to Judaism. On top of that, his mother was an Arab, called a Nabataean. And so here you have a man who is not a Jew, but eventually becomes king of the Jews. How does that happen? We talked about that last week, and we're going to pick up tonight with how Herod the Great, after the Roman Senate had made him king of the Jews, his family reigns over Judea from 40 BC until 70 AD, until the temple is destroyed by the Romans. How did this non-Jew become king of the Jews? By way of just a quick review, last week I told you that it all begins with a family fuss among the Maccabeans that the Romans fixed. The only queen of Israel, her name was Salome. She died in 67 BC, and she had two boys. And these two boys fought each other for the throne. The guy who should have taken the throne of Israel as a Maccabean was a gentleman by the name of Hyrcanus II. He was the son, the oldest son of Salome. But he had a younger brother named Aristobulus II. And Aristobulus wanted to be king. So guess what? Aristobulus attacks Jerusalem, kills all the followers of Hyrcanus, his brother, and says to Hyrcanus, "Listen, I'm not going to kill you, but you better get out." So Hyrcanus II flees to Petra, where little Herod is a boy. He's 6 years old. And Hyrcanus II, who was king and high priest of the Jews, fleeing for his life from his younger brother, becomes best friends with Herod's father, Antipater. And he hides in Petra. Well, Pompey, the general, as he's taking his Roman army east to smash the Parthians in the mouth, he takes a little side trip to what we call Damascus, Syria. And he's vacationing. And all of a sudden, here comes Hyrcanus and Aristobulus within weeks of each other. And they petition the Roman government for help. They say to Pompey, the general, "Listen, my brother is at odds with me." Hyrcanus says, "I should be king of the Jews, but my brother Aristobulus has forced me off the throne." Aristobulus comes and says, "Hyrcanus, he wants the throne, but he's in hiding. I'm the more powerful Jew. I should be there." Pompey says to himself, "What are these brothers fighting over? I want to see for myself." So General Pompey marches his troops to Jerusalem. And as I showed you last week, he walks into Jerusalem. Hyrcanus' followers open the gates, and Aristobulus, who is high priest and king, says, "You're not going any further. You're not coming to the Temple Mount." And he fights Pompey. He fights him. His followers fight the Romans. Well, they're no match for General Pompey and his soldiers. And General Pompey defeats Aristobulus on the Temple Mount, walks into the temple, and then desecrates it by going in. He's an Italian. He's a Roman general. He walks straight into the temple of Yahweh because he wants to see if there's gold and silver in there. What are these boys fighting over? And that is the beginning. This happens in 63 BC. That is the beginning of the Jews' hatred of Rome because you have a pagan who desecrates their temple. Pompey finds nothing in the temple. In fact, he later says, "Good night, what are they fighting over?" He leaves, but guess what? He's so angry with Aristobulus for fighting him on the Temple Mount that he takes the king of the Jews prisoner and his boys back to Rome. And in the triumph of Pompey, in shackles is this king, Aristobulus, and his boys, including now, listen to this, a fellow by the name of Antigonus. Now you need to remember this for what you're going to learn tonight. Antigonus is the son of Aristobulus, and now they're prisoners in Rome. And guess what Pompey does? He says, Hyrcanus, you're now going to be the high priest, and by the way, we'll even let you be king, but you're a vassal king. You'll do what we say, but you're king of the Jews and high priest. Good riddance to your brother. Have fun. And Antipater? Huh. Who are you? You're not a Jew, are you? No, but you're good friends with Hyrcanus. Okay, I'll tell you what. We're going to make you procurator. You're going to collect taxes for Rome. You're going to have a lot of power, Antipater. We trust you more than we do the Jews. You're an Arab and an Edomite. So guess what? Antipater, in the year 63 BC, when Herod is 10 years old, Antipater moves to Jerusalem, and Herod is raised on the Temple Mount with his father being the man in power under the high priest Hyrcanus. Now, meanwhile, back in Rome, Rome is ruled by the Senate and three generals, Pompey, Crassus, and Caesar, and a civil war breaks out, fighting these three men after Crassus dies in battle against the Parthians. These two men, Pompey and Caesar, turn on each other. Crassus is killed in 51 BC, and Pompey and Caesar turn on each other, and the civil war in Rome begins. And it's the great story I told you about last week when Caesar and a warrant for his arrest is issued by the Roman Senate because Pompey has convinced them that Caesar is a threat to the Republic. And so Caesar, who's been in France, back then they called it Gaul, he's been killing people right and left. He's coming home, an arrest warrant is on his head, and he has to make a decision. Do I turn myself in or do I fight the Romans, my own people? Well, at the river Rubicon, he makes a decision to cross the Rubicon and fight. And so Caesar comes back in and he begins to fight Pompey and Pompey's men, and a civil war breaks out. And as Pompey and Caesar are fighting each other, the Parthians grow in power. Who are the Parthians? Or you remember the Persians, that old empire that Alexander the Great defeated? Well, I mean, he wiped them out. Well, these Parthians back east are Persians. They start rebuilding, if you will, and they become the greatest threat to Rome. We'll talk about them even more next week. Egypt, right down here, North Africa, it's the last empire that Greece holds on to. It's the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt. And all of the kings of Egypt are Ptolemies, the son of General Ptolemy and the son of the son of General Ptolemy. And all the queens are Cleopatra. They're all named Cleopatra. And guess what? All their brothers married their sisters. So if you look at the history of the Ptolemy Empire, you've got Ptolemy marrying Cleopatra, Ptolemy marrying Cleopatra, and so on, all the way down to the Cleopatra that you know about, who is Cleopatra VII. Pompey is killed in Alexandria, Egypt, because the king of Egypt, Ptolemy, thinks that he'll make an impression on Rome by killing Pompey. Well, Julius Caesar comes to Egypt to discover what has happened to his great enemy, Pompey. And by the way, Pompey had married Julius Caesar's daughter. And when he arrives in Alexandria and the king of Egypt, Ptolemy, says, I've killed Pompey for you, Caesar is furious. Well, the wife of the king, Ptolemy, his sister, Cleopatra VII, comes into the chambers where Julius Caesar is staying in Alexandria, rolled up in a carpet, and she's rolled out. And it's the first time that Julius Caesar meets Cleopatra. This is 48 BC. Herod is growing up on the Temple Mount. Hyrcanus is the high priest in Jerusalem, and all the action is taking place in Alexandria. Julius Caesar falls in love with Cleopatra, and he says, you know what? I don't like your brother. I'm going to make you the ruler of Egypt. Ptolemy gets word about it, and he surrounds the place where Julius Caesar is staying in the harbor of Alexandria, wanting to kill the Roman leader. And guess what? The army of Julius Caesar has not yet made it to Alexandria. He's in big trouble. So he sends a messenger. He sends a messenger to Jerusalem, and he asks for help. And the father of Herod, Antipater, who's in charge of tax collecting and the army under Hyrcanus, sends soldiers down to rescue Julius Caesar. And this is the big break for the son of Antipater. It's the big break for Herod, because Julius Caesar is saved from the siege, and Julius Caesar credits Antipater. On the way back to Rome, he says to Antipater, listen, you've been procreator. Now what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you all the power you want. And so Antipater says, okay, I'll take it. I'll be in charge of all the armies of the Jews, even though Hyrcanus is king and high priest. I'll be in charge of everything. And he appoints his son, who's now from 73 to 47, he's 26 years old. He appoints Herod to Galilee and says, you be in charge of the military in Galilee. And so Herod begins to promptly kill every single rebel in Galilee. And I need you to remember something. Jesus grows up in Galilee. It is always known as a place for rebels. King Herod, when he's not a king yet, he's just a soldier. He is stationed in Galilee and he brutally murders those who are rebelling against Rome. He's so brutal, as I told you last week, the Jewish Sanhedrin wants to put him on trial. So they call him to Jerusalem. And it's a famous story of how Herod now, in his mid-20s, marches in to the Sanhedrin on the Temple Mount with all of his soldiers, swords drawn behind him, and says, you wish to see me? And the Sanhedrin promptly adjourned and said, we're done. And they did not bring charges. Caesar is assassinated in Rome, March the 15th, 44 BC. And as I showed you last week, just a year later, Antipater, the father of Herod, and the close friend of Julius Caesar, is also assassinated in Jerusalem. Do you know how Antipater, the father of King Herod, is assassinated? The nephew of Hyrcanus II, the high priest, the son of Aristobulus II, whom Pompey removed, his name is Antigonus, he bribed the chef to poison Antipater. This is the turning point in King Herod's life. He's a young soldier. He sees his father murdered. After the death of Julius Caesar, there is a battle between the adopted son of Julius Caesar, his name is Octavius, and his close friend Mark Antony, and the two men who killed Caesar. Their names are Brutus and Cassius. And in 42 BC, at the Battle of Philippi, the same place where the Apostle Paul was imprisoned, Octavius and Mark Antony defeat Brutus and Cassius, their soldiers on the battlefield. And rather than be taken back to Rome and put on trial, Brutus and Cassius commit suicide on the battlefield at Philippi. And so now what you have is a division of Rome into east and west. Antony came to rule over the east, that is Syria, and Octavius ruled the west, that is Rome. And guess what? Here enters Cleopatra again. After Julius Caesar had been rescued by the father of Herod, Antipater, he had taken a cruise down the Nile with Cleopatra, and she'd become pregnant with his son that she gave birth to later, called Cesaron. Mark Antony, when he becomes ruler for Rome of the East, Julius Caesar is now dead, he goes south to Egypt, and he falls in love with Cleopatra. Herod now has stayed in Galilee and in Jerusalem. His father is dead. Mark Antony is now gone to Egypt. He's got a lot of power, but all of a sudden, here comes the Parthians. The Persians break through into Jerusalem and take over. Now remember, Hyrcanus II is still high priest. He's in charge. Herod's dad, Antipater, is now gone. So Herod's the greatest military leader. But here comes these Persians, these Parthians, and they enter into Jerusalem in 40 BC. And guess what they do? I didn't tell you this last week. It happened in 40 BC. When the Parthians enter the Temple Mount, Antigonus, remember him? The son of Aristobulus II, whom Pompey had taken back to Rome with his father. He had escaped from Rome, and he had come back east, and he joined the Persians. And he said, listen, the Romans threw off my father's reign. You help me. You help me, and I'll help you. The Persians enter Jerusalem. And they make Hyrcanus II get on his knees and bow before his nephew, Antigonus, who's come to the Temple Mount. And Antigonus, this is a brutal story, reaches down to his uncle, who's the high priest and king of Jerusalem, and he bites off his right ear, bites it off, and then spits it out. Why? Well, in Leviticus chapter 8, verse 23, it is said that when the high priest is anointed to the position of high priest, the blood of the sacrifice is to be placed on the right ear. And Antigonus was ensuring Hyrcanus II would never again serve as high priest. Now, Herod sees the Persians coming from his platform in Jerusalem, and he takes his family and he flees to Masada. And he says to his family, "You wait here. I'm going to go to Rome because the Parthians have come in and they've invaded. I'm going to let the Romans know what has happened, and I'm going to ask for their blessing to be king." And so he takes his family to Masada, and then he gets on a ship and he sails to Rome. And in December of 40 BC, this half-Arab, half-Edomite, non-Jew, who'd grown up at the temple under Hyrcanus II, who was the best friend of his father Antipater, he tells the Roman Senate what has happened. The Parthians have come. The man you put in as high priest and king, Hyrcanus II, he's been deposed. Antigonus, the man, the young man that you'd captured along with his father Aristobulus II, he escaped from Rome, has gone to the Persians. Now the Persians, the Parthians, have taken over. I will go back and I will defeat them, but you've got to give me an army. So the Senate gives to Herod an army. Now, on this map, I'm going to show you what Herod does. Now, remember, it's December 40 BC. We are counting down to the birth of Jesus Christ. Herod has just been appointed by the Roman Senate king of the Jews. But you've got Antigonus on the throne. Herod gets on a ship in Rome at the port near Naples. And he sails between Sicily and Italy. He sails all the way to this little place called Acre, A-C-R-E, very famous city just north of Haifa. In Julius Caesar's day, it was called Ptolemy, but now it's Acre. In fact, the last battle of the Crusades happened at Acre. He sailed there, and then he had to fight his way to Jerusalem, because think with me now, the Jews hated the Romans. They loved the Persians. Under Persian rule, they thrived. Then the Greeks threw off the Persians, and the Jews hated the Greeks. Then the Romans come in, and they throw off the Greeks, and the Jews hate the Romans because they keep desecrating Yahweh's temple. But the Persians leave Yahweh's temple alone. In fact, the great legend, I don't know that it's legend, I think there's a great deal of truth to it, Cyrus the Persian, when he released the Jews from captivity in 539 BC, he said to the Jews, "You go back and rebuild your temple, we'll leave you alone. And when you rebuild it, you offer some sacrifices to your God and you ask him for blessings on the Persian king." The Persians never desecrated the temple. So when the Parthians came in and installed Antigonus, the Jews, they were happy. Well, here comes Herod. Guess what he does? All along Galilee, he kills all the Jews that are opposing the Romans. In fact, I wish I had a picture of this. We were in Israel just this year, and there are some cliffs to the north of the Sea of Galilee, and some great stories of how the Jews hid in the caves of those cliffs, the Valley of the Doves, to hide from Herod and the Roman soldiers as they wipe out all opposition to Rome. And then Herod moves down the coastline. He bypasses Jerusalem. He moves down the coast. He gets Jaffa. He takes it in a battle. And then guess where he goes? He goes down to Masada. Why? He's got to rescue his family. He left them there 3 years earlier. And when Antigonus gets the throne, when the Parthians put him on the throne in Jerusalem, he hears that Herod's family is at Masada, so he sends troops down to surround Masada. Herod goes down to rescue them, and he makes it just in the nick of time. He rescues his family, just when they were starving and they were out of water. And then he circles back to Jerusalem, Herod does with his troops, and in a battle for the city of Jerusalem, Herod breaks in, defeats the Parthians and Antigonus. He arrests Antigonus, and then he has the Romans behead him. 37 BC. And according to Roman history, it is the only foreign king ever beheaded by the Roman government. Antigonus's head, he's the last Hasmonean to reign, is carried back to Rome and displayed. And now Herod, in effect, becomes actually king of the Jews. So sometimes you will see that Herod becomes king of the Jews in 37 BC. That's when he broke through Jerusalem and defeated Antigonus at the Temple Mount. But in reality, he was appointed king of the Jews by the Romans in 40 BC. Now, before Herod broke through and became king of the Jews in Jerusalem, he took a little side trip to Samaria to marry, now get this, a Maccabean woman named Mariamne, who was the love of his life. He married Mariamne because he knew that the Jews would not accept him as king. But if he married this princess of the Maccabeans, whose grandfather was Aristobulus II, oh my word, they would love Herod because he's married into royalty. Now guess what? Mariamne, his favorite wife, was just one of 10. He ended up marrying 10 women. And in appendix, I think, number 12, there are the 10 women listed there, along with all of the descendants of Herod. And if you look at your appendix, you will see numbers circled in black on each one. Those numbers, next week, I will explain to you what they are. Because on those numbers, these are the names of the descendants of Herod that are mentioned in the New Testament. And I'll give you the key, and you will see where all of these descendants of Herod are mentioned throughout the New Testament scriptures. So Herod marries Mariamne. From 37 BC, for the first 7 years of his reign, there are 7 major things that happen when Herod is king of the Jews. And I'm just going, they're in your notes. I'm going to quickly summarize them. Number one, he takes over appointment of the high priests of Israel. Herod, the Idumean, the Arab, he begins to appoint the high priest of the Jews. Can you believe that? You see how far we've gotten away from the Old Testament instructions of who is to serve as high priest. Now, guess who wants it? His old buddy Hyrcanus, who's still alive. He'd been taken prisoner by the Parthians. But when the Romans came and defeated the Parthians, he escaped, or he was let loose from his bonds. And he wants to be high priest again. Hyrcanus II, the best friend of his father, Antipater. But he can't be high priest. Why can't he be high priest? Because his nephew had bitten his right ear off. He can't serve as high priest. And so in your notes, I've given you the name of the person that Herod appoints as high priest. There's a second thing Herod does. He drowns Aristobulus III, the brother of Mariamne. He drowns him in his summer palace in Jericho, in the swimming pool, because Aristobulus was only 17 years old, the brother of his wife. And when Aristobulus would walk through the streets of Jerusalem, all the girls would swoon and all the people would shout, "We want Aristobulus as king! We want Aristobulus as king!" Threatened by Aristobulus, Herod had him drowned. And in a moment, I'll show you the picture of that. Number three, he kills everyone else he believes to be a rival to his power. In your notes, I've given you all the people he killed. He ended up killing Mariamne in 29 BC. He kills his uncle. He kills his mother-in-law. He kills his own 2 sons. Herod kills anybody that's a threat to his power because he knows people don't want him to be king. Number four, Cleopatra VII of Egypt, she's still alive. She's still in love with Mark Antony. And she wants all the land back that the Ptolemaic kingdom used to have. And so Mark Antony, who's now the greatest power of Rome in the East, To please his lover, he says to Cleopatra, okay, I'll give it to you. So he starts piecing away at King Herod's land in Judea, giving it to his wife, Cleopatra. And it enrages King Herod, but there's nothing he can do because he reports to Mark Antony. And then, of course, as I've already mentioned, Octavius fights Antony because there's a split in Rome between East and West. And Octavius sails to fight Antony for power over Rome. Back in Rome, all the people were saying, look at Antony. He's in love with that Greek woman. He's becoming more Greek than he is Roman. And so Octavius sails with his navy and he fights Antony and Cleopatra in a naval battle called Actium in 31 BC. And he demolishes the navy of Ptolemy of Egypt. Cleopatra and Antony escape. They go back to Alexandria, but rather than be captured by Octavius, they both, like Brutus and Cassius, commit suicide in Alexandria. Herod visits Rhodes to convince Octavian that he is loyal. Who is Octavian? Octavian, he's also known as Octavius. He is the great nephew of Julius Caesar. When Julius Caesar died, he had no heirs, so he made Octavian his sole heir. He's the most powerful Roman other than Mark Antony. Mark Antony and Octavian fight for power. Octavian wins. And by the way, as you know, I'll mention it in just a moment, this Octavian becomes the first Caesar of the Roman Empire. Before Octavian, Rome was a republic. Octavian changes his name to Augustus, which means high, Caesar in honor of his father. Augustus Caesar, and he's the Roman emperor when the New Testament opens. Herod visits Rhodes to convince Octavian that he is loyal to him. Because remember, Mark Antony was in charge of the East, and Herod reported to him. Now, Octavian defeated Mark Antony, so Herod has to convince him on the island of Rhodes, look, I'm loyal to Rome, not to a person. And then Herod eventually goes to Alexandria to visit Octavian again. And he pleads, will you give me back all the land that Cleopatra gave or took from me? And Octavian gave him all the land back. That's 30 BC. For 7 years, Herod has had to fight for his position in Jerusalem. For 3 years, from 40 to 37 BC, he has to fight to get to Jerusalem. For 7 years, from 37 BC to 30 BC, he's got to get things settled. Well, in 30 BC, things are settled. And now Herod begins to build. And from 30 BC all the way down to his death in 2 BC, these are the building projects of Herod. And if you go to Israel today, you'll see them all. Remember the place where he kept his family safe from the Parthians? It's called Masada. Herod built an incredible fortress castle at the top of Masada. It's the number one most visited place in Israel today. And if you go up there, I mean, it is unbelievable to walk into the palace of Herod and to feel the breezes that flow through the baths and his bedroom. It's extraordinary. It took thousands of men to climb all the way to the top of this fortress to build it. And it is an extraordinary place. And I've shared with you before, in 70 AD, when the Romans wiped out the Jews, finally, the last remaining Jews had gone to Herod's palace, Masada, and had committed suicide. And today, even to this day, when special forces for Israel take their pledge of allegiance to protect the homeland, they fly special forces to the top of Masada, and they give their oath of allegiance to the government of Israel, and they always end their oath with these words, no more Masada, meaning we will wipe out everyone else before we allow ourselves to be wiped out. Okay, so that's Masada. Exactly. Jericho, another building place. Jericho, a winter palace was built by Herod in Jericho. And do you see the swimming pools right here on this map? That's where he drowned Aristobulus III, in Jericho. Herodium was another place that was built by Herod. Now, this is in Palestinian territory today. When we were driving back to Jerusalem on our way back from our tour this year, we could see it off in the distance. Herod's tomb was found in 2010. He was buried at Herodium. It was another palace that he built for himself, the Temple Mount. When the Jews came back from Babylonian captivity in the 530s BC, and under Zerubbabel, they rebuilt the temple, the old men wept when they saw the footprint of the temple because it was so small, and they remembered the glory of Solomon's temple. Well, by the time of Jesus, the Temple Mount was incredibly massive, one of the great wonders of the ancient world. Why? Why was it so large? Why was it so massive? Why was it so brilliant? Well, because Herod wanted to appease the Jews, and he built up the Temple Mount and made it a massive place. And it's that same temple that the disciples asked Jesus about. They said, look at the beauty of this place. Isn't it grand? And Jesus said, I tell you the truth. Not one stone will be left standing upon another. And they're like, they come to him across on the Mount of Olives looking at the temple and say, when will this be? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the Jewish age? When is this going to happen? And the great prophecy from Matthew and Luke and so on is Jesus talking about this temple being destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. And as I've said over and over again, most Christians take that prophecy and they think it's about the end of the world. And it's not. It's about the end of the Jewish age. All right, here. This is the tomb of the patriarchs. It's in Hebron. You can't see it today because, again, it's in radical Muslim-held territory. There are some Jewish enclaves near here, but it's very difficult to visit, very dangerous. Herod built this over the tomb of the patriarchs, meaning Abraham and Jacob, where the bones of all the patriarchs of the Jews were buried. Why did he do this? He's pacifying the Jews. This Arab, this Edomite who's not a Jew is saying, look, look, look what I'm doing. I'm building you a great palace, a great place of worship over the tomb of the patriarchs. I'm redoing your temple. Okay, but the greatest project of all was Caesarea by the Sea. In honor of Caesar, Augustus, he built a city, a great port, a man-made port called Caesarea by the Sea. It was stunning. This drawing here doesn't give you any semblance of how massive it was. This is the amphitheater that's being excavated today at Caesarea by the Sea. It's the amphitheater where the Apostle Paul was taken to give his defense for why he was a follower of Jesus Christ. Because by the time of the Apostle Paul, anytime he went on his missionary journeys, he would always leave by Caesarea by the Sea, which used to be just a small hole in the ground called Stratton's Tower. But Caesar came along and said, you know what? Or Herod came along and said, I'm going to build a city in honor of Octavian, of Caesar. And so he built Caesarea by the Sea. He built Banias, or the sanctuary of Pan, and he dedicated a temple to Caesar there. So many building projects for Herod from 30 BC until his death that even if you go to Israel today, you see these massive building projects in terms of the ruins. Now, as I've mentioned, in 27 BC, after things have settled down, Mark Antony is dead, Cleopatra is dead, Octavian is not only the ruler of the West, Rome, he's now the ruler of the East. The Parthians have at least been handled for a while. They're pushed back into what we would call Iran. Now you've got Rome ruling all of the Mediterranean. You still have the Roman Senate, but there's only one man with power. It's the adopted son of Julius Caesar, the man Octavian, who takes the name Augustus Hyas Caesar in honor of his great uncle and adopted father, Julius Caesar. And he reigns as Emperor of Rome. This is the first Emperor of Rome. It's the official end of the Republic of Rome. He reigns for 41 years. He dies when Jesus is 18 years old. We have come now to the opening of the New Testament. What I want you to understand is this. Herod and Augustus Caesar were very, very close friends. Herod's father, Antipater, had saved Julius Caesar in Alexandria from Ptolemy. Julius Caesar had honored Antipater and Herod by making them military power in Judea. Octavian and Herod met on the island of Rhodes, and they talked in Alexandria, and they made a pact. So when Jesus comes along as the Messiah, born in 4 BC, you have Rome ruling the world. All roads lead to Rome. The common language is Greek because the Romans didn't make everybody speak Latin. Everyone was already speaking Greek, so Koine Greek became the language of all the people that Rome had conquered. And Augustus and Herod reign over Israel. So when the scripture opens up in the book of Luke, and in the days of Augustus Caesar, there went out a decree that all the world should be taxed. And this happened when Cyrenius was governor of Syria and Herod was king of Judea. And everyone went to be taxed into his own city, including Joseph and Mary, for Joseph was of the house of Bethlehem. And so the house of David in the city of Bethlehem. And so they go to Bethlehem to be taxed. And while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered, and she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, for there was no room for them in the inn. And the scripture says, there came wise men from the east, Parthia, Iran, who'd been schooled in the school of Daniel, to Jerusalem asking, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. Herod, not knowing what it was they were referring to, called all of his men, his wise men, the chief priests and scribes, and demanded of them, where is this king to be born? Remember, he's not a Jew. Where is this king of the Jews to be born? And they said to him, in Bethlehem of Ephrathah, for thus it is written by the prophet Micah, and thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, you are not the least among the princes of Judea, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. So Herod, when he had heard this, called the wise men from Parthia to him again and said, listen, go to Bethlehem, and when you have found the child, bring me word again that I may come and worship him. And they did. They went to Bethlehem, but being warned of Yahweh in a dream that they should not return to Jerusalem, they departed and went their own way home. You have here, in the construction of the birth of Jesus Christ, the entire history of the world funneling to the time when Jesus the Messiah, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, would die on the cross for us, be buried, rise again, conquering sin and death for you and for me, saying to us, we who trust him will be co-heirs with him for all eternity, and saying, my kingdom is not of this world. Now the good news of the risen Christ. At Pentecost, all the people came to that room, received the Holy Spirit, and then were sent out to tell the good news to the nations. And guess what? They traveled on smooth, straight roads built by the Romans. They spoke a common language of Greek, the language which your New Testament is written in, and the good news of the risen Savior was spread to all the nations within a short period of time. And you're sitting here tonight with faith in Jesus Christ because the God of the universe has orchestrated history to be nothing but the unveiling of his story. So my prayer is that as we have seen the rise of Herod and his reign over Judea, you might understand even more how Jesus fits in to the narrative of history. And then next Wednesday night, what I'll do is I will show you from the birth of Christ, we'll pick up right there, we're going to start right there, to the death of Herod, which was just a few months, at the most a couple of years after the birth of Jesus. All of the sudden now, Israel, Judea, is broken into four parts. so that the four sons of Herod reign. And we will walk through the New Testament as we see the Herodian dynasty interacting with the early followers of Jesus Christ, beginning with the disciples. John the Baptist was beheaded by a descendant of Herod. At the request of a woman named Salome, because she was married to a son of Herod and then left him for another brother. And John the Baptist said, "What are you doing, you adulterous woman?" And she said, "I want his head." All of these things in the New Testament, these are the descendants of this wicked king, Herod. We will take a look next Wednesday night and trace through the New Testament the Herodian dynasty. And what you'll see is that by the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, that's when the last Herodian is deposed from the throne and the Jewish kingdom comes to an end. You know, you've done very well. We will have a test next week. You know, I went back and listened. I went back and listened to a couple of podcasts. And sometimes, Rose, you know, I think, man, I'm just going too fast. I'm saying too much. But then I listened to it and I thought, it's not too bad. You know, I could follow what I was saying. I could do that. So, yeah. So I think if you listen again and again and again, it might begin to click. But I'm telling you, when you read the New Testament knowing this, and the Old Testament, comes alive. We got 45 seconds. Is there anybody that has an urgent question tonight? Or, yes, sir, John.
You made the remark earlier at the beginning that the Jews did not have a king over them.
Yes.
They were ruled by Babylon. And the king of Babylon.
Yes. Yes. Good point. Good point. Good point. John makes the point. I made the statement. There were no kings over the Jews. And he makes a good point. There were kings over the Jews. They just weren't Jewish kings. I should have said they had no Jewish kings because you had the Babylonian king, you had the Persian king. Good point, John. Go on. Yes, Jim. Oh, you know what? That's an interesting statement. If you didn't hear, we'll close with this. We were on the bus. The comment Jim made was he saw a television program the other night that said Jesus was not born in Bethlehem of Judea. He was born in Bethlehem of Galilee. True story, Jim. We're sitting on the bus with our guide just a few months ago, Uwe Hall. I have a map in front of me. I have never heard of Bethlehem of Galilee. And I'm looking there saying, wait a minute. What is this? It's up there by Nazareth. What is this city? I've never heard of it. He said, it's Bethlehem of Galilee. And we had a great discussion. And I think what you have here, and we'll close with this, because Bethlehem is the city of David, and because Joseph is from the family of David, by the way, when you begin reading the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew, it goes all the way back to who? King David. Why? When you think about Matthew and Luke and the disciples who are living during the days when the Herodians are on the throne, they are saying to the disciples and to those who believe in Jesus, this is the rightful king of the Jews. He is the descendant of David. Begins to make sense. But what Uval said, and I agree with, because you have several from Judea, Bethlehem, who ended up making a home in Galilee, they settled and called their little community Bethlehem. You have the same practice here in Garfield County. In 1893, when the land run took place, there were people who'd come a long way from Russia, and they named their community Kremlin. You had a lot of people who had come a long way from Germany because of famine to get land, and they named their community Kiel. They named their community Mino. They named their community after the place they had come from. So Uval said, Jim, very likely some of the family of David had made their way to Galilee, and in honor of their hometown, the city of David, they named it Bethlehem of Galilee. Next week, we got two more weeks. Next week, part 3, King Herod. You're dismissed.